Do you like wrestling trivia? Then check out the 5-Star Match Game, the pro wrestling quiz show. I'm Joe Gagne, and every episode, I grill 3 contestants with 5 rounds of power-packed wrestling trivia. We have over 30 evergreen episodes in the archives covering WWE, AEW, Japan, Mexico, and much, 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 much more. Play along at home and check it out today.
Hello, do you like New Japan Pro Wrestling? Are you a Shin Nihon freak? If so, check out the Super J-Cast with Joel and Damon on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network.
And even if you fucking hate New Japan Pro Wrestling, listen to the Super J-Cast anyway. Not just for our great show reviews, analysis, and pastrami sandwiches, but there's also usually some dick jokes somewhere in the obligatory opening 30 minutes of absolute nonsense we chat about every single week. That's the Super J-Cast for all the best talk about New Japan Pro Wrestling, crisps, and pornography.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
To the highway, in a brand new day, over the rainbow, gotta let it go. So fall. Rain is a gun.
Welcome back to Open the Voice Gate for November 11th, 2025. We are members of the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. You can find us on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network feed or on our own dedicated Open the Voice Gate feed, wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on social media at Open Voice Gate. And if you would like to donate to the show, click the link in the show notes. It'll take you to our redcircle.com landing site. You click the red boxes to sponsor this podcast, and you can set up a one-time a reoccurring donation, no obligation whatsoever, but we would like to thank all of our previous donors. I'm one of your hosts. It's your old pal, Mike Spears, joined alongside your other host, Case Lowe. And Case, I just have to just get this out of my system here. He's gone. Nico is gone. And it feels like unsatisfying.
Nico Harrison is gone. I don't know if this was real or photoshopped, and we live in a post-truth society, so I guess it doesn't matter, but I did see a photo today of his Instagram bio, and it was changed from general manager of the Dallas Mavericks to girl dad, which, if that's true, that's incredibly funny. If that's not true, that's still incredibly funny, just in a different way. But you know, I would like to think that even our most Euro of listeners would know about the Luka Doncic situation. For those that don't, 9 months ago, Nico Harrison was running the Mavericks, traded at worst one of the 5 best players in the NBA, somebody still in their 20s with massive upside who had just taken their
27.
Team to the final. Yeah, 27, who had just taken their team to the finals the year before, and traded him for the constantly injured Anthony Davis, and then talked a lot of smack about Luka Doncic on the way out of the building, which is not what I would have done, as Luka is now very much in shape and dominating on the Lakers, and Anthony Davis is hurt.
And classic even, breakup mindset there. Everyone knew this would happen with Luka immediately, right?
Oh my God, like, yes. No, it's literally the ultimate revenge body, and even with the Mavericks improbably winning the number one pick in the draft lottery this past year, which I'm certainly open to your conspiracy theories, anybody's conspiracy theories on how that turned out to be, because it was such a statistical anomaly that they won. You know, they got Cooper Flagg, and I'm still very bullish on Cooper Flagg in the long run, but it has been a tough start for him. It's been a tough start for the Mavs, and Luka without LeBron and the Lakers has been an absolute world beater. So, you know, I think in a just world, I think in a right world, this would have happened after the first game that Luka played for the Lakers. You know, it was a colossal mistake that should have been somewhat rectified immediately. Instead, we had this 9-month saga where we all knew this was coming. For a very brief moment in time, it looked like the Mavs were maybe a little bit smarter than we had given them credit for. But they are, in fact, bad at basketball this year, and Nico Harrison is out of the job.
I am certain that Nike will probably hire him within the next 6 months, or the LA Lakers should. Because one thing I did learn today, Case, during all this coverage, because, you know, national holiday kind of, but when you have this kind of thing breaks in like a market like this, that becomes everything that anyone talks about all day, at least within the media. I did not realize, like, talk about the tale of two franchises. When Mark Cuban, the former primary owner of the Dallas Mavericks, sold the team to Miriam Adelson, there was a big talk about the control share, and he was, and then it later came out because of all the Luka news. Everyone was like, "Doesn't Cuban have the share?" And it's like, "No, Nico Harrison managed to glad hand his way into basically making all decisions." But interestingly enough, do you know who still has a control share of their team, even though they just sold the team for a massive amount of money? Some might say an accurate valuation for its franchise.
I do not.
Jeanie Buss still has the control share of the Lakers.
Oh, I did not realize that.
Yeah. Tale of two franchises. You know, one guy gets out of town, thinks he has control and doesn't. The other team ends up getting the guy. They end up getting out of town, but they still have control of the team. And they're $10 billion richer.
Not a good situation in Dallas, just all the way around. I think from the Cuban exit onwards, things have gone very poorly with the one caveat that they did make the NBA Finals 2 years ago. And now that could not feel longer ago.
Yeah, no, it feels like the one thing you can do is trade everyone but Flag and Lively for picks, and just your window doesn't exist. Your window is maybe 4 years from now, but you have to build it straight up with those two.
It'll be interesting to see what happens when Kyrie comes back, because I don't like Cooper Flagg at the point, at least at this point in his career. I think it's a little unfair to have him run the offense, given the fact that he's a rookie and not a natural point guard, even if there are natural ball handling abilities there. I would like to see how he would play not running the offense, and I guess we'll have a look at that at some point this season. But for now, it is dark times in Dallas.
It might be dark times in the Metroplex, but Case, it is a hot time over in Dragon Gate, as we are now fully deep into the King of Gate 2025 tournament. Case, that is Dragon Gate's number one championship. We had last week, we talked about the kickoff day at Corken Hall. That was on Thursday, but we've had virtually at this point three quarters of the first round be decided, four more matches coming up this week, and then getting into round two. But Case, I think, like, just leading off the show, we should just talk about the tournament as a bracket and where it's at. And I feel like I kind of want to hand the ball over to you to see where we want to get going with this.
Oh, that's exciting. You know, I enjoy just the symbolic nature of hitting King of Gate every year, no matter where it falls in the calendar. And this is now the second year in a row that we've had it in November, which is always an interesting time. Last year, we did not see most of these King of Gate matches. This year, we were greeted with the news at the Corken show last week, which we talked about on last week's episode. If you missed that, we did a King of Gate Corken review last week, and then I also have a written review of that show up at voicesofwrestling.com, but we were greeted with the news that we would get the tournament matches on the network at some point. And I will say that I am quite happy with the turnaround. The fact that we have the matches from the 9th and the 10th on the network already is a much better turnaround than I was expecting. So from a general vibe standpoint, I'm satisfied. I'm not fully in love with how things are going, but I'm satisfied with how things are going. I thought that was a middling Corken show, one of the weaker Corken shows of the year, and certainly one of the weaker opening night Corken King of Gate shows that they've had in their history. But I enjoyed this Kobe show, and I have found for the two house show uploads, the show on the 9th and the show on the 10th, for there to be one match that is worth going out of your way to see on each of those shows, and then a fine undercard King of Gate match as well.
Yeah, I would largely co-sign with that. I think I'm a little bit higher on the second uploaded match into Tori maybe than you are, but
I think everybody I think I liked it, but I think everybody likes it more than I do.
I mean, I thought it was in general, fine. I put it at a 3, but in comparison, comparing that to what we got between Kai and BB Hulk, it's just, to me, I feel like there was a huge modicum of difference there, to be honest. But yeah, I feel like that we knew that it was kind of a nebulous thing of, okay, everything would kind of be up there. And for them to kind of quietly say, oh yeah, no, everything from Tatori, and I'm blanking on the other city, but the 9th and the 10th is already up there. And some of that probably is made easier that it was the end of the tour at Tatori, and they're off basically up until Thursday this week. And then they have another set of 4 shows. So you kind of have like this nice period, I feel like, that at least in theory, that the uploads can kind of come out on when they return from tour. And I know that next week with Gate of Nostalgia in Tokyo, it's a bit of a longer one for that. But I feel like at least for like what we would want for a knockout style tournament, especially with the idea of some of these places that they're going to aren't the biggest towns that they are, that they tour, and especially not the buildings of that, having them up in like this kind of manner, you're right about it. It was a pleasant surprise. And I have to say, at the least, I came away from Kobe Art Center a lot more positive about the day's tournament matches than I was coming out of Cork, at the very least. I thought that there was some real good wrestling there. So a smart bit of business that I think happened as well. But in general, I'm pretty pleased with where we are after the first week of the tournament.
Well, I want to get into the bracket stuff right away. I guess real quick before we do that, because I think breaking down the bracket is a little bit more interesting than breaking down some of these matches. But spoiler-free match recommendations on my end would be Rita versus Dragon Daya from Kobe, Gianni Valletta versus Dragon Kid from Kobe, El Cielo versus Strong Machine J from Kobe, and Yamato versus Hyo from Kobe. So now that I look at that, I realize it's all the tournament matches from Kobe, which is actually a delightful surprise. And then on the show that followed that, which was in Matsuyama, I would strongly recommend as well the KZ versus Jason Lee match. And then the following night in Tatori, I would recommend in Jackie Kame's hometown, Jackie Kame versus Kagetora. That would be what I would be sure to check out from King of Gate. If you've missed anything so far, Mike, do you have anything else to add there?
Yes. So I will talk about it a little bit more in tiers. I think that the one match out of the 8 tournament matches that's worth going out of your way for between Kobe, Matsuyama, and Tatori is Yamato versus Hyo. I think that was by a good margin the best match of the weekend. And then the Tatori match of Kagetora and KZ versus Jason Lee from Matsuyama, I would slot that right below that. And then after that the one match that I think that we might have a little bit divergent opinion on, I did not really care for Strong Machine J versus El Cielo. I thought those two didn't have good chemistry whatsoever. And it had a fun finish, but I didn't think it had necessarily the polish that I would hope for that match. But by and large, I think everything tournament wise, other than Hulk versus Kai, is worth going out of your way for.
I would agree with that. I will circle back to El Cielo thoughts as we progress throughout this podcast. The bracket as it stands now, I'm just going to go through these first round results. Yuki Yoshioka defeated Madoka Kakuta. We have yet to see the Takashi versus UT match that, correct me if I'm wrong, Mike, is that in Nagoya? Is that in UT's hometown?
Yes, that is UT's homecoming show on Thursday. It is already sold out, by the way. So the winner of that match goes on to face Yoshioka in round 2.
Not to get off base already, did I read that the January Nagoya shows are already sold out as well?
It's a different building.
It's a smaller room, but they are doing a doubleheader,
kicking off the year, yeah, on the 10th.
And those shows are sold out.
There's no tickets available on Lawson's, at least.
The daytime show, is that sold out as well? Yes, it is. Yeah, okay, so smaller building, but UT doing some business in his hometown, which is always nice to see. So we will get that match later this week, and we will also get Masaki Mochizuki versus Kota Minoura later this week. The winner of that match will face Shun Skywalker, who defeated Naruki Doi and Korakin. Ishin versus El Kakui is now set for the second round. Jackie Kame in his hometown defeated Kagetora, and he will get the winner of Susumu Yokosuka versus Ben K. And that match is happening
Saturday in Yokosuka.
Thank you. The same night as Mochizuki versus Minoru. I've got two tabs open. I couldn't flip over fast enough.
Yep, I got you, and I can go over what's going to be happening on the round two matches from this weekend too.
Yep, so we'll get Rita versus Kai in the second round, as well as Ryoya Tanaka versus Yamato, which is a rematch of Tanaka's debut match. We'll get Gianni Valletta versus KZ in the second round, and then the winner of Mochizuki Jr. versus Yoshiki Kato will wrestle El Cielo in the second round as well. So that is where we stand. Yoshioka, Skywalker, Ishin, Kukui, Kame, Rita, Kai, Tanaka, Yamato, Valletta, KZ, and Cielo guaranteed into the second round. And a few of those spots still open, which we'll figure out later this week.
Yeah, and just so everyone knows what to expect for this week, the shows are in Nagoya, Yokosuka, as well as one other tournament show in Saga, or in Fuji City in Shizuoka. In Shizuoka, there will be the start of the second round. We have one of those matches decided. That's going to be Rita versus Kai in the second round, and then the winner of UT and Takashi will be facing Yuki Yoshioka, also in Shizuoka, on Sunday.
Yes, so I would say through the results of the first round, you know, I'm still very surprised by the Tanaka Homari finish, because when these brackets first came out, I thought that Homari might be a threat to win the entire thing. I'm, for as much as I love Shun Skywalker, slightly disappointed that he defeated Doi, just because I was hoping that Doi was going to have a pronounced run in this tournament. Other than that, I think things have been chalk, with the exception of Yamato versus Hyo. That match headlined the Kobe Art Center show, and I know you have strong feelings about this. I do as well. I kind of want to talk about that match before we go any further.
Yeah, I think that is... I think I like it more than Doi versus Skywalker, so I guess technically it's my match of the tournament at this point. And The thing is that they did kind of a sneaky thing in this match, at least with how it was formatted, worked, and especially with the Kobe kind of crowd. We kind of got what would have been, in theory, if Yamato retained at Kobe World in July case, and he continued defending the belt and racking up defenses, when Hyo would have been up in the lineup, when it would have been his time to have his first defense, I think it would have looked a lot like this match. And I think for that, it just was such a real like tour de force of Hyo, who, I mean, he has a busy November already with that Taiji Ishimori match at Gate of Destiny, and then with this one. And I think my huge takeaway out of this was like the chemistry that they have, where Hyo was going for the Samson driver and Yamato kept on kind of finding ways out of it, and getting the kick out of a Galleria, and then Yamato having to go like, oh, so this is serious business here, let's go Ragnarok and finish this thing. And for a city that there's been a lot of really strong matches this year, I mean, I think about Hamare versus Jackie Kamei as part of the Brave Gate tournament, the whole final day of Rey de Parejas. Might not have been in this building, but I was going through my spreadsheet and my Dragon Gate notes this week, Case, and it just so happens that like while I went through it, I kept on going to myself, damn, they have really had some strong matches in the hometown this year. And I feel like Yamato versus Hyo and King of Gate was not like the high of Kamei versus Amare back in April, but I think it was as strong of a singles match as Hyo has had maybe ever. And I think that Yamato really kind of brought it back to his Dreamgate run and how he worked the match. And it very much felt like that this was the mirror universe of what that Dreamgate match could have been if Yamato was still champion.
You hit on the point I was going to make right at the very end of that, which is, you and I have watched Hyo's entire career. We both remember him debuting. We've followed quite a journey over what has almost become 9 years. I went to the spreadsheet archive. You know, I've got match the year tracking for 2014 onwards, which is frightening to think. I've been writing down wrestling matches I like for 11 years now, but I've got...
Oh, Kate, before we get into this case, so you have this spreadsheet. I just have like my stack of notebooks. I'm just making sure, like, if something were to happen, I need to get that spreadsheet. You need to get the notebooks. Okay, good. Go ahead.
Yes. No, the power of Control F is something that I cannot take for granted. I like being able to search for things in my spreadsheets because, well, I end up in a situation where I watch a match like Yamato versus Hyo, and there's a number of spots that I want to break down here because I thought there was some really, really high-level wrestling done. Some things that as the match progressed, I was hoping they were going to do and that they did, which is, yes, some great form of confirmation bias, but also at some point, you just know what you're wanting out of a match, and when you get that, it's quite exciting. And I left this match going, I think that might be the best singles match of Hyo's career. Let me fire up all the spreadsheets I've got with his name and let's take a look at the best singles matches of Hyo's career. And to my shock, I have only had three Hyo singles matches at 4 stars or higher. Does that number surprise you?
I would say no, just because of he was a shtick guy basically up until 15 months ago.
Yeah, that makes sense. You know, I expected maybe a Mochizuki Dojo match to pop in there, maybe a Brave Gate match to pop in there. But even as I go back and I look at his Brave Gate run, you know, I remember a lot of these matches topping out at 3¾ stars. It was the joke we used to make about Dai. It was also something that held true for Hyo. You know, I really liked that Fumita match he had last June, but that was a 3¾-star match. The singles matches of Hyo that I have at 4 stars or higher are Hyo versus Jason Lee from October 15th, 2022. Now, where that falls in the calendar, just without looking, I would assume that is a Kobe Sambo Hall show. I'm going to confirm right now, just to be sure, October 15th. That is a Brave Gate title match between Hyo and Jason and Kobe. I remember that now, that headline, that show. That felt like a big deal. Also on that show, Yuki Yoshioka versus Kaito Nagano. May we pour one out for Kaito Nagano. Opening match, Dragon Daya and Madoka Kakuta versus Ishin Ihashi and Mochizuki Jr. I'm sure I like that. I should look through my notes there.
Oh, 2022, we're talking about Ishin Sudo being member of M3K.
Yeah, they're listed on Cage Match as members of M3K.
Yeah, so, I remember this card exactly because I also... If I were to pull up Dragon Gate Network, I could tell you exactly like what era of Hyo this was. This is the kind of Hyo fan I've been over the years. This was when he was kind of doing the Razor Ramon thing with the toothpick and the vest. That it was this era of Hyo at that point.
So I really liked that. That was a match that, again, I went 4 stars on. In chronological order, the next match that I have at 4 stars or higher would be from the beginning of 2024. And again, these are only singles matches. In 2023 and 2024, he had a very large number of matches that I thought were at 4 stars or higher, but those were multi-man matches. You have to go to Corken Hall, January 11th, 2024, another match that headlined a show. This was Shun Skywalker versus Hyo in a singles match. This is right when Hyo was turning and beginning to form what would be Big Hug.
Yeah, this would 2024, Big Hug exists. Or this would have been like,
well,
right,
Big Hug as Hyo and Monte.
Right, yeah. No, he's already turned face at this point and is Brave Gate champion.
They might have formed as an official unit on that show because it was Monte versus Kame in a singles match on the undercard. I don't remember the specific timeline there, but I had that at 4 stars. And then I also had, from just a few months later, another Brave Gate match, Hyo versus Yasushi Kanda from Champion Gate in Osaka 2024, which had no business being as good as it was, but I thought those guys worked so hard, and I really liked that match. I thought it was old man Kanda at his best, right when he was winding down that miracle run. I thought it was Hyo full of life, full of energy, doing things that he does in an excellent way. And I have those three matches at 4 stars. And I am happy to report that leaving Yamato versus Hyo and Kobe on November 8th, 2025, I have that match at 4¼ stars, making it the best Hyo singles match in his career.
Yeah, and it really does feel like at this point he has broken through that 3¾-star general kind of tag here. What did you think of Yamato kind of baiting Hyo somewhat through the like with like the Galleria sequence in this, because I thought that it was kind of really interesting how Yamato was like going to like that kind of depth in this tournament already.
I thought the way that both of these guys worked this match was absolutely fascinating. You know, I thought Yamato played the exact role that he should have, very similar to the Dragon Daya title defense. I think very similar when you go back and you look at that Dreamgate run, just to reference what you were referencing earlier, you know, very similar to that Daya match, very similar to that Strong Machine J match, given his relationship with KZ. It even reminded me of that KZ match a little bit, where he was not only in control for most of the match, but there was something greater at play. Yamato using his years and years of experience, that veteran status, to sort of hold a dominance over Hyo that even Hyo, almost 9 years into his career, it pales in comparison to the run that Yamato has had. So you had Yamato in his element, playing this cocky, dominant veteran, which I think is his best effort. And then you had Hyo personifying Scrappy, doing everything that he should have been doing while working underneath. And this match, the longer it went, turned into an ankle match. You know, there's the figure four spot that goes on for quite a long time where Hyo's in the middle of the ring. Yamato's got him locked in a figure four. I found that to be very compelling. I like that spot a lot. What made me so happy was the spot that I was sort of hoping as this match progressed, I knew Hyo was going to get there. I knew he was going to get to the spot because it's a Hyo match and he can't go a single match without doing this, which is when he's at the corner, guy runs at him in the corner, he goes up over the top, does the back handsprings across the ring. That's the thing that, you know, in Vegas at that Game Changer show we were at, that got a huge reaction because that's just a level of athleticism that we might take for granted because Hyo does it every match. But in America, not a lot of guys can do that. So Hyo, after having his ankle worked over for most of this match, he does those back handsprings across the ring, but that final one, he plants, he grimaces, he holds the ankle, and Yamato comes back and does the go to hospital two, which he would normally do in the corner to somebody's head. He does that to the knee of Hyo and takes him out. And I thought that was brilliant. I knew they were going to have to address that spot in some form or fashion. I was open to the idea of Hyo doing those back handsprings cleanly, powering up, fighting through, fighting spear spot, run of offense, and then, you know, whatever the finish was going to be whatever the finish was. Instead, he sells it. Yamato times that dropkick beautifully. That, to me, was the highlight of the match. That was Hyo working at a high level and Yamato working at a high level. I thought that was great.
And I think that it also, as you're saying, like the way that Yamato really has like found that edge since 2024, or at least into like this stage of his career, it felt like the thing that like absolutely like was like the right move to do at like that time. It's like when Yamato is like taken to certain depths, it's not necessarily that he is someone like Yuki Yoshioka who's just going to start powering through it and he's going to survive on just force of will. Yamato is going to be like, oh, okay, how do I get this back to my advantage? Oh, yeah, no, this is going to be, you're way too agile. Your ankle has already been worked. I'm just going to target that, and it's going to leave me that opening to my closing stretch. And I just think that for someone like to be able to like pull off that, and then also for just like Hyo, as good of a babyface performance that you would that you'll see all week, I feel like, just because it's just he at this point, like we talked about how because of like the good hug, the big hug thing, about how basically he then like was able to kind of like tap into the charisma aspect and crowd connection, and at some point, and one could say, look at the Doi produce show with the match with like Jiro, that sometimes and Rey Parejas, it just becomes a little bit unwatchable in that kind of thing. But when he's able to kind of gear that into a match itself, I feel like that he has some of the most powerful crowd connection out of anyone working today. Like that, I think that he is someone that he will be on the KZ path for a while, but like he is going to have that fan base behind him, and being able to tap into that and really only come alive with that, like starting year seven of his career, is a real testament to him.
I think this is the sort of match that you have to watch volume up, no commentary. I think you get a lot out of hearing Kobe and hearing the calls that Hyo gets and really enjoying this match the longer that it goes. The other thing that I thought was great was Hyo going for the Samson driver, Yamato countering that into an ankle lock. Hyo gets to his feet. He misses an enziguri, which I thought was great, and Yamato turned that into a sleeper hold. And from there, he's never really able to recover. You know, Galarrea and then the Ragnarok for the finish, and Hyo's done. Again, 4.25 stars, the best Hyo singles match I've ever seen. And, you know, unless you want to factor in, say, a dead or alive cage match, which he was brilliant in a year and a half ago, for as many great matches as Hyo has been a part of, and when you factor in those multi-man matches, some of those unit disbands matches, all the great
Vegas
things he's
main
done,
event.
Vegas yeah. main event, I think this was the single strongest Hyo performance I've ever seen. This was my favorite thing that he specifically has ever done.
Because this is Hyo as Hyo and not Hyo like in the format, right? Like this is sheer force of himself versus like the Vegas six man where it's like, all right, we're doing it. We're doing the modern version of the Dragon Gate six man. Time to go into the crowd, y'all. So it feels like really nice to see. And especially for someone who had like that level of momentum, and especially in a tournament that this year, it being single elimination, having that kind of match coming out of the tournament as your only tournament match feels really strong for him, especially since this is a format that this is it. We're not doing a loser revive battle royal this year. This is it for it. So it was the right performance for him to have for this tournament this year.
I agree. I think this, even in defeat, I think this did a ton for his profile. I am intrigued by your thoughts on Cielo versus Strong Machine J.
I think that so first and foremost, like, we have to address the Cielo of the matter of that they've been very careful about where Cielo is and when he and matches that Cielo has been booked in. You notice that he will come out in Saipatra matches as since Saipatra got announced, but he's not necessarily wrestled all that much. And I wonder if that's a level of that into it. So El Cielo advances with a spinning tombstone pile driver in a match, 5 minutes, 28 seconds. And I really like the start of it. We got activated Strong Machine J, and it felt like, in a way, you had like Strong Machine J in like the all white mask versus El Cielo of his black mask. And I was like, all right, this is actually feeling like this can be kind of a hot contest. But as things kind of got moving within the match, and I felt like within some of the spots that we now kind of know as like the big shine spots for El Cielo, like the cartwheel evade and stuff like that, and like his the way that he gets into the limit bomb, it feels like that these two guys just were not on the same page to me. And it just, at least to me, like, it was a 2.5-star match that could have been, with this kind of format, easily a star higher for me, but it just did not. I don't know if I'm the person alone thinking this, but it just it underwhelmed when I was anticipating this to be a strong match with how they built it, with like Cielo winning the Battle Royal last month, and I felt kind of really let down by it.
I approach this El Cielo match as it got underway the same way that I would approach like an early 2000s CZW undercard match, where I just wanted to see Cielo do cool moves, and every move he did was super cool. And I think I was focused far less on flow or chemistry, or really, to be quite honest, anything that Strong Machine J was doing, because they've designed Cielo's offense to where everything blows my mind.
Oh, like the way that he converted into the spinning tombstone pile driver was sick as hell. Like, don't get me wrong, there were some really like great stuff. Like, he ends up doing the cartwheel evade after the first time, where he kind of lands on SMJ with it, and the way that he's able to get into the moves, and especially like those sorts of things with maintaining a level of aura, absolutely still did that. It just, like, maybe like the build up and having SMJ like cut like the spirited promo against the guy into a match that ends up being 90% LCLO maybe set my expectations a bit higher for where it should have been. When this, if you just do this as like an LCLO bomb show where he comes in, wipes out the leader Strong Machine or Strong Machine J, the leader of Natural Vibes, and stands over him kind of looking down on him like, is this it? That rocks. But just like the match of itself and like the flow, as you were saying, just didn't work for me.
So I think, you know, it's a good chance to look at the bottom of the bracket because Yamato and Cielo are in similar places. You know, that second round, the way that it's set up, it's going to be Rito versus Kai and Ryoya Tanaka versus Yamato and right. the winners of those matches facing each other. That feels like a very obvious Kai-Yamato match. I don't understand why they wouldn't go in that direction. I think Rita can afford to loss to Kai. I don't see any reason why Tanaka should beat Yamato. And then you have Yamato beat Kai. That puts Yamato in the semifinals. That makes too much sense to me to ignore. I feel like that's the way that block is going to go.
Yeah, at least like this, the top half of that side of the bracket. Unless you kind of really are doing like Tanaka is on a different level. He pulls off the upset against Yamato, and then that is going to go more towards D-Curd's dissolution, because guess who couldn't beat Yamato as Brave Gate champion outside of the tournament? That was Dragon Daya. So like, I could see that kind of being a thing, even though Daya beat Yamato in the tournament last year, that they might want to play up a little bit. But it does seem like neither Rita or Kai are going into the semifinals. It's most likely going to be Yamato, but I can't discount Tanaka's potential of an upset.
I hadn't really thought about that. I mean, that's an interesting angle. I think the way, even though we're getting all the matches this year, I think the way they format this tournament in November always throws me off, because if there was a second TV building where there is Yamato versus Tanaka and it was in Osaka or it was back in Kobe or it was in Fukuoka or even Kyoto, I think logic would go, okay, well, that opens the door for a Tanaka victory. But as I go through this schedule here, that match is
it's
going
in Kunimoto.
Oh, is that okay? That doesn't really tell me anything, does it?
Yeah, no. And they have not announced where the quarterfinal. So we only know matches through next weekend, actually. So it's Kunimoto. So that's a Genki show. But that one is going to have Ishin and Kikui and Yamato and Tanaka on the 22nd.
Fun lineup there, but I'm still thinking that Yamato versus Kai makes too much sense there, and then they'll do Yamato in the semifinals and we'll go from there. The bottom half of that side of the bracket, so you've got Valletta versus Dragon Kid, which we'll talk about here in just a second. Valletta advanced there. KZ versus Jason Lee. KZ advanced there. You're going to have Cielo versus the winner of Kato and Mochizuki Jr. I think it makes way too much sense for Kato to win that match, and I think Kato will beat Cielo. I think they're setting Kato up for Gianni Valletta. And if there wasn't a heel champion, I would say the way they're treating Yoshiki Kato would make me think that he has a possibility of beating Yamato. I do not think that's the case right now. I think they'll do Kato versus Cielo, and then Kato versus Valletta, with Valletta beating Kato. And then you find yourselves in a situation where I don't know if they're going to scramble the brackets come the semifinals, or if we get Yamato versus Valletta in the semifinals, which I would be incredibly excited about.
Yeah, I don't know if they're scrambling it. At least like this lineup I'm reading off of is the Aspora blog for it. And it's all it says about after the second round, the quarterfinals are happening in Oita and Umuta, and that all they say is two tournament quarterfinal matches will be held on both those nights.
Yes.
So we don't have anything.
Yeah, so no more intel there, but it does raise the question, you know, I had Hyo as the winner of this tournament when we approached it and got the brackets and got the layouts and everything. I thought he would beat Yamato, and I thought they would set up Kakuta versus Hyo as a Cork and Hall Dreamgate match, and obviously we're not going to get that now. And as we get through most of the first round of these matches, I am now left staring at the possibility of Gianni Valletta, King of Gate 2025 winner, and I have to say that really intrigues me.
And I think this is a good time for us to jump into that Gianni versus DK match case, because I really enjoyed the episode of Pro Wrestling Paradise that you did with Alan this week, talking about the career of Eddie Guerrero, and it kind of turns it into a discussion on little things like stumbling and baseball slides and the parts of the wrestling world where we don't really like see anymore. And I have to tell you, the more that I watch Gianni Valletta, and the more we have like this Gianni Valletta pseudo kind of face turn, or just like the tweener shift with Cypatra, buddy. I think like it must be the most fun thing in the world to work Johnny Valletta, because this match he had with Dragon Kid, it was a fun ringside kind of brawl, and it kind of in a way, this match, especially with like the way that like working with Johnny Valletta, other than body slams, you're not necessarily bumping all that lot. It must be the most fun to work to work against this guy in this company, especially if you're a veteran like Dragon Kid and knowing you're going to take the JOB here. Johnny catches an ultra hurricanrana attempt, and he just sends Dragon Kid into the mat with a huge choke slam, the King Kong knee drop to win. And we need more of the little things, because I think Johnny Valletta does a lot of the little things and the things that aren't necessarily splashy in Dragon Gate, and it's really become one of the most like engaging acts in all of wrestling today.
I will continue to repeat myself. I think the work they've done with Valletta is the single greatest booking accomplishment in wrestling over the course of the last 2 years since he came into Dragon Gate. I'm completely blown away by what they've done with him. The fact that they've been able to keep this act fresh, and the fact that they've now been able to pivot this act into something else. And I find Valletta's work in this new role, I'm stunned at how well it's going. And it's also, you know, it's worth mentioning, I should say, he's doing this against perpetual babyface, you can't turn this guy heel because nobody other than Ultimo Dragon hates him, Dragon Kid. And he still effectively was able to not come across like a deranged killer that you should boo, but a deranged killer that you should cheer. And I thought the work here, the only way I could describe it would simply be a nice piece of business between these two. And I know that now every time Valletta's in the ring, I am looking forward to that camera being in the lower corner of the ring underneath the turnbuckle, shooting that King Kong knee drop the way that they do it. I look forward to that spot now. The spot, the camera angle, the finish, I look forward to it all, and it continues to deliver every time out.
Yeah, and like the little things, like the idea that Dragon Kid goes for a Bible. Okay, so we've watched Dragon Kid matches since he basically debuted like throughout the show, but at least as a podcast, but off and on for the last 9 years. Yeah, the Bible is like the last gasp. Okay, if Dragon Kid hits the Bible as like his flash pin, you anticipate that to be three and then the major upset. No, Johnny kicks out at one, and it feels completely deserved, because how can that even face Johnny Valletta?
It was excellent. Again, the way they treat him, it goes back to almost like the Don Fuji stuff we used to talk about, where the people that would enjoy Don Fuji most are the people that would never watch him. The people that would have enjoyed Kaito Ishida versus Keisuke Okuda matches the most are the people that will never watch them. And there's always this through line with Dragon Gate where they do such classic old school wrestling, and they are ignored by a certain population of the fan base because they have their preconceived notions as to what Dragon Gate is, which is incredibly frustrating. I was just reading an old DVDVR. I was doing research for the Mochizuki Hall of Fame episode that we did. And, oh, God, what crowd did he compare it to? Dean was writing about the Absolute Amente 2001 cage match, and I believe he compared Dragon Gate. Oh, God, I got to see if I can find it now. This is going to drive me nuts, because he compared it to a territory in a way that I had never really heard it described before. And I thought it was so interesting the way that he did it. Let me see if I can find this real quick. I'm going to talk through this Google search, because I had it pulled up somewhere, and now I forget the exact way that he described it, but I want to get it right if I can find it. I don't think I'm going to be able to find it, which is going to drive me crazy. Let me see here. That's not doing anything. Nope, it's pulling up the wrong DVDVRs. That sucks. 2001. Anyways, he was describing Toriumon as like Crockett, you know, at its peak with the crowd fervor and the women and the heat in this promotion. He was describing the heat of it. And Valletta's just another one of those guys that he should be sung from the mountaintops, from the flagship podcast and from the Segunda Cata guys and from Dave and Brian, if Brian were ever going to watch wrestling that wasn't WWE. you know, every single outlet that has any sort of critical voice should be praising the work that Gianni Valletta has done. It's going to be interesting for me as we get into FSM 50 season, because, you know, it's not like Valletta is Nick Bockwinkel in between the bells. And I am also not watching any of his work that happens outside of Japan. So this year, I've got, you know, maybe 20 matches to go off of televised. You know, he came in and did Rey de Parejas this year, at least did that tour of Rey de Parejas this year. He wasn't in the actual tournament, and then left after the Mochizuki match in May, which was a brilliant piece of business, and then has come back in October and has picked up right where he left off. At the very least, that's a guy on a ballot that, because of the state of wrestling, is going to be filled with Dragon Gate guys and CMLL guys and not much else. I don't know. Is Valletta the 50th best wrestler in the world just because he understands who he is as well as he does?
I really think so.
Are we just at a point where we're... Because I would also hear the argument, to contradict myself, I could listen to the argument that maybe we're just overinflating the very basic fundamentals, and that this is no different than a Sugun Ikeda guy saying that Matt Hardy's 2009 ECW run is the greatest North American championship run of the 21st century. Maybe that's how we sound to some people, but I do think there's something deeper with Valletta there. And the thing that always blows me away with him is that this all could have gone so wrong. I mean, you and I watched that Corkin debut match where he did all of the right things, at least in my review, I wrote that he did all of the right things, but he played to crickets. And it very easily could have been a thing where he showed up in January, he left in May. A year later, we went, wow, that was weird. Remember when they brought in this guy, put him in the Chris Bosh, Human Tornado, Kevin Steen category of weird foreigners that have come over? And instead, like, I can't imagine Dragon Gate in its current ecosystem without him. I mean, he's just become such an amazing part of this promotion, and I'm so thankful that he's here, and I'm so blown away by the work that he's done.
Yeah, and it's really, at this point, like, and at least, like, me within, like, my wrestling fandom and, like, what keeps me kind of interested. And there's always the aspect of Dragon Gate that, just because it's that chocolate and peanut butter that works for at least my brain and what I want with, like, pro wrestling. But it's also, like, the idea of you have someone like Johnny who essentially, like, doing the heel Bruiser Brody, now kind of turning into local big man wrestling, like, 1980s style. And it's just, like, it is such, like, an interesting thing to add into the formula, that it's maybe not necessarily me becoming a small things guy and really talking about Rita's gator rolls and how more people should use gator rolls as transitions, but instead it's just, like, the idea that you're getting something, at least with Valletta, that is it should not work. And I tried not to be feet in my mud in the mud too much about Valletta as soon as I saw how it was in the trios matches, and then when they figured out how to use him best in singles. But it's really turned out to be the gift that keeps on giving. And I mean, Valletta versus KZ, I'm just absolutely fascinated about, like, I expect that Valletta is going to win, obviously, but just, like, what that match is going to be is now. I think, at least as I'm looking through the second round matches and at least to anticipate advancing onwards, unless there is some upset with Mochizuki Jr. over Yoshiki Kato and we get Jr. versus CLO, I think this is my most anticipated second round matchup already, is Valletta versus KZ.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I think that match is going to be fascinating. Credit to you. You found the DVDVR review that I was looking for. I'm going to read this real quick because I think this is such great writing. This is from DVDVR. Oh, my God. I don't even have the number. I am useless.
135.
Tonight. Thank you. I got nothing going for me. What a bummer. I thought I was going to be able to find that while I was talking, and I couldn't.
But let's pat ourselves on the back for the teamwork there. You gave me the time to go search and find this by just basically doing web crawling and it's hard to find those DVR things, and you have the great quote. So, I mean, good for us.
This is Dean talking about the 2001 cage match with Shima, Magnum, Darkness Dragon, Mochizuki, and Dragon Kid. And about halfway through his review, he writes, "The Toryumon gets the scathing attacks from the Puro Dork Kingdom for being too US in its booking, but the heat Toryumon generates is the Watts and Houston level, not the cheap Stanford kind, so it's okay in my book. I actually love that kind of shit. Heel and face stables is the coolest form of wrestling if done well, and this is all done pretty well." And then he continues on to the match, and I'll just read this here. "The match itself is fucking brilliant from a story standpoint and from a wrestling standpoint." I don't know, man. I feel like a lot of people not watching Dragon Gate would really like Dragon Gate if they just watched it.
Yeah. Just turn brain off, just vibes. Just go with it.
It's not even that's the frustrating thing, is it's not even a vibes promotion. There's some deep story stuff going on here. And I've said this for 5 years now. I really think it's true. I think it's why I'm so insistent. I mentioned this on the Allen podcast today. It's why I'm so insistent on, even if it makes my daily schedule a little bit difficult, especially when there's two shows that I've got to review in the span of 1 week. It's why I'm so insistent on keeping the pattern of doing the written reviews for voicesofwrestling.com, even if I know people don't consume those whether they used to, because they don't consume writing the way that they used to, because nobody knows how to fucking read anymore. But there is something to be said about documenting history in written form rather than audio. And I think there's a large portion of English-speaking Japanese fans that when Jay stopped doing those big Cork and recaps and those big promo translations, people assume that Dragon Gate stopped telling stories. I still think, I mean, this is a promotion rich with story, rich with detail. It doesn't always come through in the way that we hope. You and I both thought the Twin Gate build for Osaka was lackluster, which is a shame because that ended up being such a great match. But this is still a story promotion. It's far deeper than a vibes promotion, than a good time promotion, than a turn your brain off promotion. It is still a story-driven promotion, but I don't think, whether it's just not keeping up with the promotion the same intensity that they used to, or not watching the English commentary when they have a chance, I don't know what it is, but it's still there. The things that made Toryumon great 20 years ago and that made Dragon Gate great 10 years ago are still active in 2025.
Yeah, and talking about like the storytelling, like with that Twin Gate match not necessarily having the build that we wanted, we came out of Gate of Destiny with a lot of build towards the opener on Kobe, the fourth of the King of Gate matches, Rita versus Dragon Daya. Dragon Daya, after losing the belts, immediately said, Rita, I'm coming after you and getting revenge for what happened. So, I mean, you even have a little bit of story and show-to-show storytelling here. So Rita versus Dragon Daya. Rita advances with turning the end over, which is Daya's backpack kind of driver that he does sometimes. I had to look that move name up. That was going to be done off the top rope into an avalanche retanic. I really enjoyed this one. And it was kind of like the fascinating part of Daya's career right now, where he's now the veteran having to kind of get through younger and faster and smaller problems than he is. And Rita has had himself a real strong start of November. And I just really enjoyed how it was like full rush from the start, and Rita doing gator roll transitions. Just that is the small thing that I would love people to pick up, using a gator roll transition into another kind of move, because that works out really well whenever Rita does that.
I almost went notebook on this.
I was 3.5, so you're not out of school here.
I mean, I had to like talk myself out of it because I thought that might be a little excessive, but Rita's a flawless wrestler. You know, that guy doesn't make mistakes. He constantly innovates. I loved the middle rope double stomp that he did. That was, I don't know if I've ever seen anybody do that move quite like that before. He's doing all the gator roll stuff. He's got a great drop kick. He's got a great dive. He does the middle rope retanic. Like, this guy's unbelievable. And I thought this match was stellar. I get 3.75. I had to talk myself out of going 4. And the right guy won too. With all due respect for Dragon Daya, I'm so much more interested in a second round Rita match, even if it's going to be short and he's going to eat a medio impact and be out of the tournament. I like that Rita got this win here.
Yeah, and I like the aspect of Daya was never really able to catch up with Rita's speed, because aspects of like the telegraphed like standing moonsault where Rita gets his knee up in like the exact in like the most painful way to get up for like that kind of thing, and it just it really kind of felt like Daya was trying to survive, and that's why he had to go to like the big gun trying to go for the end over off the top rope, and instead Rita faster, more wrestling talented, I think that's fair, grappling talent, was able to get out of that and just powerbomb him into the mat for three. Felt deserved. Rita has a new theme song. We couldn't hear it very well, but everything is looking up Rita right now.
Yeah, I, you know, one of these years, I think he's going to go on a miracle run, and I'm going to quite enjoy it. I don't think that time is now. Obviously, being settled in love and peace, you can't possibly have good things. You know, we're biting off more than we can chew.
He's a twin cage champion.
I know. We're biting off more than we could chew as is. I'm sure it'll be a zero defense championship run, and then Jackie Kame will do nothing for 6 months, and then he'll have another 4¾ star title match, and we'll go, God, they should do something with this guy. Just feels like that's the direction we're headed. But God bless him. I thought this match was great. I love the intensity of this match, too. You know, this was the kind of junior heavyweight wrestling that I get really excited about, where they're flipping around, they're moving really quick, but everything looks like it's killing the other guy. I really thought highly of this match. This Kobe show, the non-tournament stuff did not do a ton for me, but the four tournament matches, I thought were all really, really fun.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Just to touch on the non-tournament stuff, Case, before we move on and talk about the other two nights of tournament action. We had a 10-man tag, Fuji, Monte, the ex-Mochizuki Dojo kids, versus Ultimo, Kung Fu Masters 2, and Mandai Ryu. It was the slingshot rocket punch to get the win for Reach Tominaga. Yeah, that felt necessary. Yasushi Kondo was the latest veteran to be befuddled by Jiro Shinbashi, and he wins with a briefcase spot that seems to be like his version of the failed German suplexes, people stealing the briefcase and shooting him with it. Royal Sambo, UT, won that. And then we had a three-way tag, Yoshioka and Tanaka of D-Courage versus Kakuta and Ishin of Gaja Dokuro versus Shunmari of Saipatra, breaking down with a injury for Hamare, his heavily taped shoulder gets incredibly attacked, and Ishin gets the win by referee stop. Hamare is off shows, and they did kind of injury angle, taking him to the back afterwards with that. So he's off of future shows, and hopefully that this is just a little shoulder thing and not one of the big shoulder things.
I agree. Well said there. I was enjoying that match until the finish. I thought they had something going there, but I understand why the finish was what it was, given the state of Hamare's shoulder.
Yeah, and that also makes a lot of sense why Hamare was kind of booked to the way he was in the tournament. If it his shoulder has been taped up virtually since his debut, I feel like it's been more taped up than not taped up over the last year. So hopefully, like it's something that's rest or like not a serious shoulder thing. And we know how shoulder things can become kind of ongoing. So one hopes that especially at 20, that his career is not going to get a big stop by this.
I agree.
All right, moving on to Matsuyama. We only have the two tournament matches there. Let's talk about the week one first. BB Hulk versus Kai. Kai converts a first flash into the authorized Gonosuke clutch to win in advance. He faces Rita in the second round. And hey, we got a Kai and a Hulk match in 2025, and it was exactly why we were kind of tired of seeing these guys have matches in 2021.
I will say, I think you have slightly more disdain for this than I do. BB Hulk completely whiffing on the apron spin kick that he does was a bad look. Very rarely in Dragon Gate do you see a spot look that bad.
Yeah, it did not feel like it was a tournament caliber match. And when you have a tournament that is single elimination, it kind of sucks when this is like the BB Hulk match in the tournament is one that he has bad spots. And it just felt like it was mandatory in the worst kind of ways, the match.
I would say counterpoint. We've got BB Hulk out of the tournament now.
Yeah, no. Imagine this was Hulk versus Rita second round. I don't know.
I do not want to see that. The Kai match is going to be short because it's all that's how they have their singles matches. You know, I get the ongoing Kai Rita story that has sort of bubbled underneath the surface for the last few years. It'll be quick. Rita will try to steal a win. Kai will kill him. But I'm way more into Rita versus Kai than I would be Rita versus Hulk.
That's fair. Then the second match we had Matsuyama. KZ versus Jason Lee. Big time match. Felt like a big match. And I thought that outside of the main event in Kobe, this probably ends up being the best tournament match of the weekend.
Interesting. You liked this more than anything on the following night?
Yeah, I like this more than Kagetora and Jackie Kamei. I had them both at 3 3/4, but if I was picking one over the other, I think I would take this one just because I felt like that this was kind of almost worked like a heavyweight style match, and it was a lot more like strong, tight work than things in that match going up until the closing stretch where Kagetora just slapped the crap out of Kamei for 3 minutes.
So I would as well. I'm very surprised. I thought you would come on here gushing about Kagetora and Kamei, which I thought was very good, but I liked this match more as well. And I sent this match, I put it in the Discord publicly, but I tagged Jesse Collins because I know Jesse is such a big KZ fan, and my thoughts on KZ and Jason Lee are well documented. And I am so glad. This is why, to me, the King of Gate stuff going on the network really, really matters. And I love the way that they filmed this. Again, it wasn't a broken system. When they were doing the house show YouTube uploads, it was not a broken system. That was my favorite way to watch Dragon Gate. I liked those uploads more than the stuff that actually went on the network. To see these two guys work as crisp as they did, as I try to hold off a sneeze here while talking about this match, to see these two guys work as crisp as they did from the camera angle that this was shot at, which was right underneath one of the bottom turnbuckles, right on the ring, super close to these guys. I fell in love with the work of this match. This is one of those things I always go back to where I go, well, I just think the working standard for Dragon Gate is so much higher than any other company. It's why when I rank the best wrestlers in the world, there are so many Dragon Gate wrestlers. It goes to a match like this because I think universally, even if this wasn't a notebook match, I've got it at 3 3/4 stars. I just think there was a level of professionalism to this that most people cannot hit.
Yeah, it just felt like that the both the guys came in with the air of that this was going to be a big time tournament match, and it felt like that they did it. I thought that it was it kind of started off as the kind of KZ match where KZ is going to take a lot of just crazy neck bumps and it's going to be how he can survive, but how it kind of transitions over to at least like KZ turning it on, getting the CDJ, which does kind of feel like the kind of match that with KZ, if it's going to be one of like big match KZ, I feel like that CDJ feels like a big moment, and then having that kind of flow into the impact and just kind of in a way and two moves completely crater Jason Lee. I felt like that. It felt like the kind of finish that you'd want to have for someone like KZ in a tournament. I mean, there's always going to be like the KZ fan that goes like, oh, KZ could sky to schoolboy Johnny Valletta. And then, you know, maybe it ends up being Kato. And then before you know it, KZ's in the tournament semifinals. It could be KZ time once again. And I feel like it's important to have like that kind of performance in a first round match to kind of engender that kind of support. So yeah, I thought Jason was as fierce and as stiff as you want him to be here, and especially as like now he's really kind of matured into the heel role and kind of like what is going to be now the future for Jason Lee, now mentally kind of a little bit more backburnered, and having like a match like this and Matsuyama just absolutely rocks. Like this is the kind of match in this kind of tournament that I'm going to go back to and being like, yeah, but when I'm talking about person of the tournament, that KZ versus Jason Lee match was something special, or at least felt special.
Jason countered the running uppercut into a sleeper hold, which I've never seen anybody do before. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, it felt really vicious and earned.
That's what I like about this tournament so far, is I think, like, I almost think that's what was missing from Tanaka Hamare, is when you look up and down the lineup so far, like Hyo versus Yamato was really, really physical, and Valletta versus Dragon Kid was really physical, and KZ versus Jason Lee, these guys beat the shit out of each other. Kame and Kagetori, these guys beat the shit out of each other. Doi and Shun, I got, Mike, I can't stop thinking about the Doi 5's counter into the butterfly suplex that Shun does, where he deadlifted him off the ground in a butterfly suplex, because I've been watching Naruki Doi matches for half of my life and I've never seen anybody do that before. That match was incredibly physical. The good parts of Kakuta versus Yoshioka, they were beating the shit out of each other. Tanaka versus Homari is like the outlier here, because I didn't think they were as physical as they should have been.
And that probably, in retrospect, was because Hamare's shoulder couldn't take it, you know?
Yeah, no, it was that match and the sort of messiness of both the pacing and the execution of it, not to read too much into it, but it does seem to make a little bit more sense now.
I'm with you with that. Let's talk about Tottori. We had two matches there from the 10th, El Kakui versus Ria Fuda. This was probably, if there was the way to bet on Dragon Gate matches case, this was the one that would have been taken immediately off the board and not offered first round. El Kakui wins with a second rope, a Spanish fly that I kind of liked Fuda a lot in this. Like, Fuda's never kind of stay die, but the crowd in Tottori wasn't really like necessarily up for it, but it was more than I expected out of Fuda, and we at least got the moment of he tries to go for the Hiryu and he just absolutely eats shit from Kakui, and that was what I was kind of hoping for in this match, and since that happened I was able to slap a 3 on it and had a good time.
I was not prepared for the middle rope Spanish fly, and so that really caught me off guard in a good way, but man, was I not ready for that move to be hit right there. So that was quite exciting. I didn't know what I was getting into. You know, this is, as I continue to be Fuda's harshest critic, which is maybe unfair of me, but he always excels when he's in the ring with Mochizuki. I think the other thing that he's proven to be very good at is running into walls and running into guys that are bigger than him. So I do think Fuda looked really good in this match.
Yeah, and it's not necessarily kind of the thing that, like, Fuda having a good match against El Kakui, like, I guess it's kind of expected with like the brick wall that you laid out here. I'm just glad that there at least were a couple moments in this match that I was like, oh, okay, we're doing this now. And that amused me greatly. The hometown boy, Jackie Kamei, had his King of Gate first round match against Kaga Tora. He won with the JFK into Jackie knife. And this, I really like, I was a shade off of 4. I think I like KZ versus Jason Lee from the night before a bit more, but I kind of go back to the way that Kaga Tora just dismantled Kamei's knee in this match, and the wild seated Apache pump bump that Kamei does towards the end of this match. And I'm looking at this, I'm wondering, why am I set and thinking that KZ and Jason Lee was better than this, when this was what you would want to have between these two guys in a first round King of Gate match?
I think Jason versus KZ was slightly better than this, but I am continually blown away. And I think blown away is actually the apt term here, given the fact that I've always been historically a little bit lower on this guy than other people have. Blown away by how good Kaga Tora is in 2025 on a show in, show out basis, which has never been his reputation. It's the thing with Kaga Tora was always, when he's motivated, he will crush it. And a lot of the time he's not motivated. And I don't know what it's been this year, but when you look at the show in, show out paradox stuff, you're not getting that from Susumu. You're not getting that from Hulk. You're not getting that from Dragon Kid even. Yamato has, you know, the much, much, much higher ceiling of output this year. But there's a consistency to Kaga Tora's work that's all kind of 3.25 to 3.75 that I have become a really big fan of. I'm enjoying Kaga Tora now more than I ever have at any point in his career.
Yeah, I would say that, well, it feels like that he, I don't know what age Kaga Tora is. I was going to say, like, he turned like a round number and just decided to choose murder. Well, but it feels like, though, over, so he's 43, so that analogy completely falls apart. But it feels like this year he just has like a extra little bit of zing on everything, maybe. And that's what it is, because I feel like the he's really had that Apache punch now into like he's had that move for years. Like we've seen him do that, like dating back to, you know, Kagetora getting recruited into Kamikaze back in 2009. Like that's been kind of a constant with him. But I feel like in this match and in like the last few months, he has just been like slapping the crap out of people, and he really was able to haul off against Jackie Lee in this match. And I at least I really enjoy the way he works the Apache punch, but like the knee stuff that he did, like his slingshot sent on into a dropkick to the knee. I have always liked how Kagetora uses slingshots. Like there was that slingshot, like hand, cartwheel DDT that he did for a while. And then he's had some other stuff that he's done, like vaulting into the ring. But I felt like just like the way that he did it, it looked like he like came in real heavy, and Kamei screamed out for like death after it. And it left enough of a mark on me that I wrote it in my notes. At least I thought that it rocked.
It's not a position that I would necessarily expect Kagetora to be in, but he did come across as the perfect villain to have in a match in your hometown. You know, this was the Kamei homecoming show, and Kagetora traditionally has not been the monster that Yamato could be, or that Shun could be, or that Valletta is just by his presence, or that Mochizuki is just by his presence. But this was the sort of bully outing that Kamei needed in his hometown. It was a very impressive piece of work. I really, really like Kagetora in this match.
And I miss having homecoming matches and hometown matches.
I talked to somebody who goes to a lot of Dragon Gate shows, and they tell me time after time, the best Dragon Gate experience is the, you know, whether it's Tottori or it's Gifu or it's insert small town here where this wrestler is from, the homecoming shows are the best live fan experience there is.
Yeah, and I just think of like the Stalker performance in his hometown and all the stuff there, and how it just adds a little bit of life here, and it's nice to see. And we're gonna have another homecoming coming up this week that we'll get to see parts of Case because of the tournament matches coming up in Nagoya City for UT on the 18th on the 13th on Thursday, as well as in Yokosuka versus Sumu. And before we move on to some other stuff to close out the night, let's talk about Gate of Nostalgia coming up on Monday. We've had more and more stuff announced to it, and it's turned out to be, we don't have like a full card at this point, but we have a lot of it. And at least what's your takeaway of how Gate of Nostalgia is coming together for Monday?
I have mixed feelings on it. I don't know. I think I was more into the first version of this show than the second. So what we have now is Jiro Shimbashi versus Johnson Florida for the Iware Gate Championship. We have the most fearsome unit deciding six-man three-way tag match with Yamato, BB Hulk, and Naruki Doi, and Problem Dragon representing Mad Blanky, Deep Drunkards of KZ, Yasushi Kanda, and Arakin, and Gaja Dokuro of Madoka Kakuta, Ishin, and Yoshiki Kato. And we also now have announced the Strong Machine Army of Strong Machine J and two mysterious Strong Machines versus the Jimmies, Susumu, Kagetora, and Genki Horiguchi. And we have Masquerade, Shun Skywalker, Dragon Daya, and Coach Minora versus Diamante, Hyo, and Daya Inferno. Which of the matches announced, that is the one that intrigues me the most.
Yeah, I feel like the most fearsome heel unit thing, that's just an excuse to get a Mad Blanky performance, and then Gaja Dokuro looks strong, pinning Deep Drunkards. Am kind of intrigued about the new Strong Machines, just because I think that it would be really entertaining to have Sahara as a Strong Machine. I think he could actually really do it quite well, but that Masquerade versus RED match kind of positioning it as like the many people of which Shun Skywalker have like directly bothered, but also like the in some kinds of ways it does feel like you're having like within this match, like if we assume that they're going to get Yoshioka to do Inferno here, like it does in a way that match feels like we are going to get to kind of see something that might further build on to normal continuity shows, at least with the idea of you're having Daya having to go up against the guy who took his mask, and then Yoshioka, and at least as someone who's on D-Courage, the D-Courage Extinction Watch, this feels like something that could play into that.
Possibly. It'll be interesting to see, but you know, I think you and I both have very fond memories of covering R.E.D. versus Masquerade in real time, and even if that is not the most vintage of matches possible for a show like this, I like that lineup a lot on paper, that match specifically, so I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, and Jirio Shimbashi going up against Johnson, Florida. I know you are not a Florida Brothers guy.
That's something for you, not for me.
Yeah. It's nice to have a little treat on a show like that. And Jirō Shinbashi still remains to be pretty charming. The act seems to have some legs to it. So, you know, he's got to face his elder sometime, Case. And, you know, with Yagi, this, like, probably, you know, there's only so many more Yagi and ring performances we're probably going to get before he fully hangs it up. So, you know, it's kind of a nice thing.
I'm going to put you on the spot here. You don't have to say yes, but are you doing a written review for that show?
Let me look at my schedule for that, but I can't.
Because I don't think I am. So if you're not, then I just don't think we're going to get one. Or somebody could volunteer. We'd love to have a new writer at voicesofwrestling.com, but I do not think I'm going to be writing about that show.
I mean, I think I will. Now that I'm looking at my schedule, I feel it. So yeah,
take it away. Take it away, Mike Spears. No argument from me. And I'm looking at the show will be fine, but I don't want to do that.
No. And especially like as we saw last year with these are completely out of continuity. Just like, hey, we have another date that we have to fill, so why don't we do this versus another Buyadin, or Skywalker doesn't have a new show idea yet. You know, like that's kind of how I feel about this Gate of Nostalgia show.
Yeah.
Because it's happening right in the middle of King of Gate too, which feels very weird to me.
That does feel very weird. You're right.
But Case, there was one thing that I think or kind of two things that we had left on our schedule for this week. We promised last week we have to talk about the Glate, and we have to talk about Glate Verge Mega from Yokohama Buntai from November 3rd. And what seems to be now the last match of Shima, at least in Glate, as it seems to be if you take things at surface level. But I know you took time to see this match and to dip your toe back into Glate, so I'm kind of interested to see like what your impressions of the main event for a very unsuccessful major show for the problem half of the Dragon System.
Well, before I talk about the match, because I actually have a lot of thoughts on Shima versus Lindemann. That's the only thing I watched on this show, because I watched that first and the atmosphere was not exactly an inviting one, and so I tapped out on the rest of the show. But can you catch me up
on
whatever's happening with Shima right now?
So at least I think it was yesterday it was announced that Shima has a pretty bad shoulder injury, and that he is right now at this point he has withdrawn from all of the future remaining Glate matches. He posted basically like the doctor's note on Twitter, but it's a shoulder injury. And it seems like, as someone who was kind of went into the show on the 3rd and thinking that like, okay, we'll see what really kind of comes out of it, I'm just going to read the press release from the Glate website with this. And it's that Shima has been diagnosed with a torn rotator cuff in his left shoulder impingement syndrome, and injury to the long head of his left biceps tendons, which will require hospitalization and surgery, and he'll be absent for a while. The timing of his return will be determined in consultation with his doctor. He'll be relinquishing the G-Infinity title, and no mention about the fact that Shima's contract is alleged to expire on New Year's Eve of this year.
It's all very strange. I really don't know what to make of any of that, because as I said 2 weeks ago, I felt like the Shima contract stuff was a little bit too loud to be fully believable, and I was waiting to see where that was going to go. I have no reason to believe this injury is a work. I also have no reason to believe, and this is maybe where we'll disagree, but I have no reason to believe that this is some elaborate ruse to get out of dropping the Glate tag titles.
No. Like, the story goes, and part of the reason why everything got so weird was out of that Cork and Hall show that Shima won the G-Infinity tag titles with Kurishio Tokyo Japan. He thought, and he went up to Kurishio, or he claimed he went up to him, like, asking him, like, okay, so when do you think we're going to start defending the title? Do you think we'll do it in Yokohama? And Kurishio basically said, I don't think I'm on that card here. And Shima was going, oh, that's weird. And then the G-Rex thing got announced. So this does not feel like that whatsoever, at least if you're taking what Shima says at face value. And, like, it seemed like that the guy was actually, this was something he was a little bit into. So I don't see why he would be trying to find a way to get out of the title belt, the tag situation, seeing that that's, like, the one thing that seemed to be on the level with him in this whole entire situation.
And it's hard to take Shima at face value, but it's also hard to take any of this stuff seriously. And I think this is one of those instances where maybe I've just been doing this long enough to where I simultaneously have too much information and not enough information. And my reaction when I have that feeling is to just take a step back. I understand why you wouldn't want to take Shima at face value, but I also this seems like a pretty legitimate injury. I mean, he was a guy, and I'll get to the Lindemann match in a second here, but he's a guy who was barely hanging on physically. And I fully believe that the Lindemann match could have torn his shoulder off of his body almost. So I don't know what to make of any of this. I know it's not, it's a little like, I don't know if you saw the Bears-Bengals game last week, but the Bengals were winning huge for most of the game. The Bears made a comeback. All the Bengals had to do towards the end of the game was make one tackle on a tight end, and it would have been extraordinarily hard for the Bears to win. And they just whiffed on the tackles. The tight end ran into the end zone. Bears end up winning the game. And afterwards, Bengals offensive players were talking about, like, man, you don't understand how hard it is to win when you don't have a defense that has your back. And so if that's happening publicly, I can't imagine what's happening privately. And whether this Shima stuff is a work or a shoot, or it's a combination of both, the fact that we know so much publicly, or at least there's so much information made available publicly, means that things are weird. I just don't know what way they're shifting.
Yeah, and, like, if you at least look at this in a position of just seeing health, like, I'm not surprised that they claimed 700 for that building case. And I know you only saw the main event, but you kind of heard what they tried to do to make it sound like it was not much more of a completely empty house with it. And I think multiple things can be true at the same time here, because you have a company that, I mean, we've studied Japanese promotions now, not just with this, but with, like, those days. And it gives us, like, a little bit of more of, like, insight of getting to tell when, like, a promotion is going down south. And it's been apparent to everyone that Glade has been going down south for a long time. And maybe self-interest plays in for a little bit with it. But you also have the aspect of, I'm looking through Shima's social media, and he has a photo of himself in the sling. He's posted his doctor's note. And it just kind of, in a way, feels like that this could be all those, like, issues backstage and in front of the house happening at the same time. Also, while this promotion is going down, also when your most bankable star is now probably going to be out for, I mean, I'd be surprised to see Shima before summer of next year wrestle again, just from how those injuries are described, at least in his health. And yeah, I mean, this is a guy that we always knew had less matches in front of him than behind him. And at the very least, it was built as it could have been one of the last ones, but I just have now, like, I have a feeling that sometime in 2026, we're going to see him pop up somewhere and probably do that, like, run before you do your final run and be out of the business within the next 2 years. Like, it feels like that kind of situation with this injury to me.
I think you're right. And I think this Lindemann match might've been the last real great vestige of Shima that we're going to get, because this match took a long time to get going. It's a long, old school world title match in a way that I just didn't think Shima still had any of this left in him. So I was impressed by the length of this, first of all. I was struggling with this match for the first third of it. But when it kicked into a higher gear, and oddly enough, I thought it kicked into a higher gear when they started rolling around on the mat more, because the older Shima's gotten, I've always enjoyed his grappling. I think he's a special mat wrestler, and I wish he spent more of his career doing that sort of stuff. But it was like Shima countering a cross arm breaker by hooking Lindemann's heels and then rolling into a submission of his own. That's the sort of stuff that got me off of my couch in this match. That's the sort of stuff that this iteration of Shima's career that I enjoy so much. You factor in the concept that Lindemann gets busted open on the turnbuckle. He's gushing blood for the last 5 or 10 minutes of this match. And by the end of it, I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed this. Not quite enough to go notebook, but I'm glad that I watched it. As somebody who's watched Lindemann's entire career, somebody who's one of the biggest Shima fans there is, I'm glad this match existed. I'm glad we got the one singles match between these two that we're going to get. And I thought it turned into a pretty special match. It does feel like that, given the length, given the physicality, given the aftermath of it, Shima doesn't have another one of these left in him, which is an incredibly sad thought for me, because there are very few wrestlers I've ever enjoyed watching more.
Yeah, and it does kind of feel like the kind of match that if he is going to go out on his terms, Lindemann kind of as like the last true protege of him, saving this match and having kind of the performance where it's kind of a shame when you see like him at this state, and it's hard not to compare him to like Mochizuki and Dragon Kid and people, his contemporaries, who are in much better shape, because I feel like the match, like it's 26 minutes long. That first third, it kind of felt like that Shima needed that first 10 minutes to kind of loosen up and to get really into it and be able to perform the last two thirds of it. And at least as I've been like more watching Shima's later parts of his career, it does feel like he has that aspect of like in the past, in these Dreamgate matches that he would have, the thing would have been like, oh, they go work a limb for 10 minutes and then it doesn't play into anything else with it. And that was always the thing that dinged Shima's singles matches, was like the idea that his premier style of singles wrestling wasn't necessarily a style that would work across all demographics. And instead, I feel like he's become a lot more wily about his limitations in a match like this, where I rewatched it today. And it the fact that like Shima starts attacking Lindemann and undoes the turnbuckle like a good like 7 minutes before like they go and they do the busting up of Lindemann, and it's like one of the more gruesome like hard ways that you'll see in a while, and it just like it lulled me into completely forgetting about Chekhov's exposed turnbuckle, and then then at like the exact right time he lawn darts Lindemann right into that turnbuckle, and it the moment is just incredible. And I think that he gets better at this point as these matches go along, because it takes him that while to loosen up and be able to kind of perform at a level that he would want to a little bit.
Really fun match. Again, just for the historical purposes of it, I'm very glad that it happened. And it's worth sitting through, or powering through rather, the bad atmosphere and the slow start, because it always goes back to just, I still feel like there was an inherent level of Shima brilliance in this match that I so greatly enjoyed.
Oh, yeah.
And that was
quite
exciting. His
mind's not gone whatsoever.
Yeah. No, not you're exactly right. His mind's not gone. I mean, maybe his business acumen, but his mind in between the ropes is not gone.
But yeah, no, that's on that Glate show, like that was the one thing I really felt like anyone's worth going out of the way saying. Tamura versus Czech Giamatani match is good if you want to go back to that.
Okay, but, good to know.
But Hayato Tamura, like he does a ripcord Spanish fly as a finish, and it looks gnarly on that. And you should be happy. Your boy TJP is the next G-Rex challenger.
Once again, he is not my boy. I do not want that reputation. I cannot have people thinking that TJP is my boy.
I mean, you are the biggest Ash Wong fan I know.
I like SoCal, Surfer Dude, TJP. I don't care for the Ash Wong. I like the guy in CMLL. I wish he was there full time.
No, I don't blame you on that. How much of Doi's produce show did you get to see?
Started the Mochizuki Jr. match yesterday, got distracted, never got a chance to come back to it.
I exited after that match. I got partway through like the big three-way trios match, and other than like the joke of Rita teaming with guys that he comes up to the navel on, there was not a whole lot there for me. I felt like I do kind of want to see Ryo Saito acting like a Saito brother, so I'm going to get back to that. But as soon as I saw that they were actually putting up the King of Gate Network uploads, it kind of dropped down my priority list,
as it did for me as well. But I'll have some thoughts on that next week. I still want to go back and watch that show.
Yeah, no, I'm going to try to finish that up as well. But buddy, do you have anything else you want to touch on before we're out this weekend?
I do not.
So you could follow us on social media at Open Voice Gate. Cases at underscore in your case. I'm at Fujiheya. If you want to step into the conversation, join the Voices of Wrestling Discord, where there's a great Dragon Gate channel with matches of the week, running commentary throughout the tournament, as well as Angry 216's match of the week. As well, we have our Open the Voice Gate channel, where that's where all of our show related posts and news goes there. We have our pen tab of all of our historical shows. And Case, before we get out of here, I just want to give you and Alan one more plug. I really, really enjoyed your episode that you did with him on Pro Wrest Paradise this last week about Eddie Guerrero. It actually was the thing that kicked me off into starting my AAA rewatch, or my AAA watch. So I had the June 6th, 1992 show on as we've been recording tonight.
Yeah, for those that might have missed it on the VIP section of the Pro Wrestling Torch website, myself and Alan did about 2 hours on the career of Eddie Guerrero. We talked about two New Japan matches from his time as Black Tiger. We talked about one AAA match, and then we talked about one WWE match, but I feel like it's a largely unheralded one, and one that even if you've seen, you should go back and rewatch. And then along the way, the nice thing whenever I do a show with Alan is I just have things that I want to talk to him about anyways, and so I shoehorn them into the podcast. And I thought in the middle of that show, we had a discussion that I think would pertain to anybody that listens to this show about where wrestling criticism lies in 2025 and kind of what people like Alan and I are doing, or how we're feeling maybe being disenfranchised from a lot of the current wrestling that we're seeing. And I found that to be a very interesting discussion, and I hope that other people will as well. So the 20th anniversary of Eddie's death is on the 13th. I believe this show is going to come out on the 12th. So if you've made it to the end of this and you have not heard that show, it's worth checking out, getting the subscription for a month if you're not already a subscriber. But it's one that I know I'm very proud of. I know Alan's very proud of. I know Mike really enjoyed it. It was a really, really fun podcast to do. So if you have not given that a look, again, you get four great Eddie Guerrero match recommendations, and they're not obvious ones. They're not ones that any other podcast is going to talk about. Alan's picks in particular are really off the walls. And then I had a AAA match that I really liked. And then believe it or not, I had a WWE match that I really wanted to talk about. But again, that's on the PW Torch VIP section with our friend Alan. I had a blast doing that show, and I hope that everybody goes and listens to that.
Yeah, I need to go rewatch that WWE match after y'all talked about it.
It is so good.
I vaguely remember it happening as of the time of like while watching wrestling at that time, but I just there's something about that match that the way that y'all described it, and the fact that's freely on WWE YouTube means I'll go hunt it out versus having to go mess up my Peacock algorithm going through like all their stuff there. So yeah, but that's going to do it for this week's Voicegate. We'll be back with you next week talking about the end of the first round, the launch of the second round of 2025 King of Gate, as well as the Gate of Nostalgia show coming up this Monday. Have a good rest of your week, everyone. Take care. Bye.
Hello, Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network listeners. I am Jeff Hawkins, co-host of Shake Them Ropes with a very special announcement. If it's been a while or you've never listened to us before, the original gang is back, myself and Rob McCarron, back talking wrestling. We have no idea where this show's going to go, where we're going to keep any of the old bits or any of the old things in there. It's going to be a process. It's going to be a journey, and we'd like for you to come along with us only on Shake Them Ropes on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network.
Hey, everybody. My name is Jesse Collins, and I am the host of the Gentleman's Wrestling Podcast, a show right here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. On the Gentleman's Wrestling Podcast, we take a deep look at individual issues and stories that are going on in the wrestling world. Each episode is about a different topic, and we take a thorough and educated look at things ranging from current booking trends to breakdowns on individual performers and angles to investigations into different fan cultures across the industry. In addition, we keep a close eye on the wrestling media, and as a professional journalist, I bring a unique perspective to how current issues in wrestling are being covered and discussed through the wrestling media. We have a revolving series of guests from across wrestling punditry joining us on each episode, and we hope that you make the choice to give us a listen on wherever you get your podcast from.